All right, we are, it's December 12th, and we are in the chambers of Judge Ikuda in Pasadena, California. And we are having this interview, and the interview is being recorded, obviously. So let's start with just a very basic question. What's your full name?
It's Sandra Siegel Ikuda.
And where and when were you born?
I was born June 24th, 1954. In St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica. So I call myself a native Los Angelino, although I was immediately whisked off to Downey.
To Downey, okay. And what were your parents' names?
My father's name was Henry George Siegel, and my mother's name was Frances Rockland Siegel.
And did you have any siblings?
I have an older sister. Her name is Lorraine Siegel.
And what did your parents do for a living?
My father was a engineer draftsman at the Department of Water and Power, and my mother was a school psychologist.
And what was your early childhood like?
Well, Downey was a very conservative place at that time, and my parents were extremely liberal, so we didn't have a lot of interaction with the neighbors. They didn't have very many friends out there, so it was pretty much the family getting together and doing, I did a lot of reading and I did a lot of fun things with the family.
And what were your favorite subjects from an early age at school?
Oh, English literature, always.
And at what point did you see yourself as a future lawyer?
That would have been in 1985, probably. I had no interest in being a lawyer. My parents were very opposed to lawyers and to law school and never got over that. They still thought my career choice was a big mistake.
So all through high school, you no visions of becoming a lawyer?
No.
What were you thinking you wanted to be when you were in high school?
Well, I had taken a course in journalism, and I loved English literature, so either of those, either as a professor of English literature or as a journalist, were the two things I thought of in high school.
And did you do any extracurriculars when you were in high school?
Yes, I was the editor of the school newspaper. That was the main thing. That, and I think I took a meditation course. My husband claims that I was the president of the Bookworm Club, but there was no Bookworm Club at the time.
And were there any major issues that you had to cover on the school paper that you remember?
No.
What about your college application process? Do you remember anything about that?
Well, I was looking for a college that was not too far away from my family, but was far enough away that I wouldn't be in their house all the time. I thought it was important to become independent. And so I looked at what the best schools were in California, and I ended up with Stanford.
But at some point, you transferred to Berkeley, is that right?
And I understand I'm the only person in the world that has transferred from Stanford to Berkeley. That remains, people are just incredulous about that.
So what made you switch?
So Stanford had fantastic professors. I really learned a lot in English literature. I early declared a major in English literature. But my fellow students were very dedicated to, we work hard and we play hard, and they were not very intellectual and didn't really want to discuss what we were learning. So I felt somewhat isolated, and I understood that UC Berkeley was a much more intellectual type of process, and I transferred there, and it was true. And so I got to stay up until midnight or 1 or 2 in the morning talking about literature, so it was a good move for me.
And so you were an English major?
I was an English literature major, yes.
And did you remember any favorite classes or favorite areas of or genres of literature?
Well, I was thinking about that, and I really loved Shakespeare. And I studied with Professor Janet Edelman, Professor Ed Snow, and really have been a lifelong Shakespeare fan. But I understood that if I wanted to become a professor of English literature and continue in my academic career, I had to do something else. There were too many people who were enamored of Shakespeare to compete with. So I also took a lot of classes in 18th century English literature, and Professor Gordon Stout was one of my mentors.
So you had mentioned a minute ago that, you know, your parents were quite liberal, and, you know, at some point, obviously, you became not so liberal. Where did that happen in college, or how did that transition happen for you?
I know it's a very strange thing, and I think it started in high school. So one of the things that I've come to realize is that libertarians are born, not made. You're born with this contrarian instinct. So I remember being a contrarian really from elementary school into high school, and where you start thinking that there's a rational answer to things, and when you become more dedicated to reason, I think you end up becoming more conservative. I guess that's a little biased. So
now, how did you decide to pursue your master's in journalism?
So I did very well at Stanford and Berkeley, and I thought very deeply about going on to graduate school, and I even took GREs in English literature. And at some point, after getting close to a number of my professors, I realized I didn't really want to stay in the university all my life and in academia. And I wanted something, I was very introverted. I wanted something that would get me out into the world and see more of the world. And so I explored various options that would still use my writing skills, and journalism was one that came to mind. At that time, there was Deep Throat and Woodward Bernstein, and journalism had a lot of fashionableness. And so I applied to Columbia Journalism School, which was considered one of the best at the time. And I got into there. It was a one-year program of journalism.
And then after you graduated, you were a writer for many publications. Do you have a favorite?
Well, of course, I love the Inside Kung Fu. What was it called? Inside Kung Fu was their flagship publication, and I've forgotten the name of the company, T.F. Wong Incorporated. And, of course, I met my husband there, so that puts a little bit of a nice sheen on it. But so I would say becoming editor-in-chief of Action Films and Inside Kung Fu and some of their flagship publications was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that.
And quite different from... I think you wrote also for the Disney Channel magazine and City National Bank.
Oh, yeah. Well, City National Bank, I was a technical writer, which was very interesting because you're trying to explain to people with no experience how to be a teller. I like that sort of technical writing. City National, what was the other one?
The Disney Channel.
Oh, the Disney Channel. I love the Disney Channel. That was so much fun. We had to watch all the Disney movies and then do a little pricey, so it was all for the young or the young at heart, this heartwarming film about whatever it was.
So then what then led you to decide to finally apply to law school, especially given the your at least parents' hostility to the law?
Well, I was a little bit dumb in moving from New York and my work in publishing in New York to California, because California didn't have a really rich journalism or publication companies. So it was very hard to get a job. And I was starting to feel that I needed a little bit more intellectual stimulation than I was getting from Inside Kung Fu and the Disney Channel magazine. So I thought about a lot of options, and the people that I ran into who were the most enjoying their career were lawyers at that time. And I thought, well, I'm analytic, I'm a good writer. Let me see if law school would be a good fit.
And where did you end up attending law school?
So I ended up at UCLA. This time I had I was 8 years out from college. And so I had a life in Los Angeles, so I was looking for a law school in Los Angeles, and there's not that many. There's UCLA, USC, and Loyola. UCLA accepted me and gave me a scholarship, so it was the obvious choice.
And did you have any favorite professors or subjects in law school?
Well, I loved William Warren. I took every course he offered. He was bankruptcy and secure transactions. And then Ken Karst I had for federal courts, which was fascinating and difficult. Eric Zolt, I studied tax, which ended up being my least favorite subject, but I loved him. And Jesse Duke-Minier for property law were the ones that came to mind.
And what work did you do during the summers during law school?
Well, I worked for a firm called Altshuler, Grossman & Pines. I don't know that they still exist. They actually, I worked for them while I was in law school on a part-time basis because I was needing to support myself while being at law school. They were wonderful. I really enjoyed the work I did for them, and at least one of their partners, Sandra Chan, became a lifelong friend of mine. And then for summer, I was at Mitchell, Silverberg, and Knapp looking at their SEC and transactional practice.
And what other activities did you do during law school?
I was pretty much busy with law school and law review and didn't really have, and my life, and really didn't have much time for anything else.
What made you decide to apply for judicial clerkship?
Well, there was a lawyer at Altshuler, Grossman & Pines named Mike Sipers, and he just took for granted that I was applying for a clerkship. And I thought, well, it hadn't occurred to me, but I can see that that can open a lot of doors. And so I took his advice and applied.
And how did you end up clerking for Judge Kaczynski?
Well, again, wanting to stay in Los Angeles, I sent my resume to all of the Ninth Circuit judges. I actually interviewed with Reinhardt, and I guess it was a good thing I didn't end up there, but Judge Kaczynski called me for an interview. I think he was intentionally looking for who was number one at his own alma mater, UCLA. So I spoke to him, and he mostly
showed me... Is that a backhanded way of saying you were number one in your class?
Yes. Did some magic tricks with cards for me, and then he asked me if I wanted to clerk for him, and so I immediately said yes.
And what was the experience clerking for him like?
Well, this was before Judge Kaczynski was as crazy, had the crazy hours that his clerks worked thereafter. So it was a wonderful experience. I would not have gotten that offer because I was now, you know, or in his later days, because I had a fiance and was living pretty far from the courthouse. But I think he was happy with my work, and it was a great experience.
And how did you interact with the other law clerks? How did that relationship work?
Well, both of them are friends. David Schwartz is a lifelong friend. Stu, he's now a partner at Shepard Mullen, and Stu Banner is a professor at UCLA, and we have very friendly relations. So he hasn't sent me all of the law clerks that I would like to get from UCLA. So I think we got along very well.
Do you remember, or can you speak out any significant case you worked on that year?
I did remember one. I had to use Westlaw to get the name of it. It was Trident Center, the Connecticut General Life Insurance Company, and I look back over it. I remember now why it was so interesting. Judge Kaczynski was sitting in it was a diversity case.
Is that the case where he criticized very colorfully the Pacific drayage rule on contract in California?
Right, where you can bring in extrinsic evidence even when the contract is clear. And what impressed me by that was he thought it was very important to follow the plain language of the contract, the statute, the Constitution, whatever, and yet he was bound by precedent to apply the California Supreme Court's law. And so he grumbled about it, but did what the law required. And I was very impressed by that and was happy to work on that case.
What was it like to later serve as one of his colleagues when you became a judge on that court?
Well, it was strange for a couple of reasons. One, I remember very vividly, Judge Kaczynski, Justice O'Connor, and I sitting on a special panel in Phoenix and looking down. I was sitting to the left of Justice O'Connor and looking down the row of judges. I said, this is very spacey to be sitting here with both of my former employers. But as soon as you start working, you're just working, and you click into what you need, the questions you need to ask in order to decide the case. And so that was pretty much the way it was when Judge Kaczynski and I were on the same panel. The bottom line, by the time I started, he had taken a very different approach to judging than he had when I was a clerk, and so we disagreed quite frequently.
So how was it to disagree with him?
Well, he was very brilliant. He was a great writer, but he was often wrong, and so it was easy to disagree with him because he wasn't following the plain language of the statute or the precedential law.
How did you come to apply to Justice O'Connor?
Well, that was Judge Kaczynski told me to do that. He said, send in your package tonight. I like, oh my God. And I did so, and he helped prepare me for the interview with her, and I was privileged enough to get an offer from her.
So what was it like clerking on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, it was much more stressful than clerking on the Ninth Circuit because you were helping your boss make law for the entire United States. And she was very interested in the policy results of the opinion. I think Evan Thompson, I think his name is, just wrote a book about her called First, which really lays out how she brought her legislative understanding into her decision-making process.
And who were your co-clerks with her?
My co-clerks are still lifelong friends. Is it Richard Klingler, who's, I've forgotten the name of his law firm now, and Ivan Fong, who is the general counsel for some company whose name I've forgotten, he just changed. I'm not being very good on this. I should have looked into this more carefully. And Marcy Hamilton, who's a professor at, I think, at Philadelphia, Penn, now of law.
And what were your typical interactions with the justice in helping her do her job?
Well, she wanted us to write bench memos. So we all wrote bench memos on the cases. And then she'd come, she would ask us questions and often ask for additional research. And then the Saturday before oral argument, she would have us all in and make usually something I couldn't eat, some very hot chili, for example. And we'd go through it with all of us there, what her position would be on those cases. And then when we wrote opinions, she would review them, the drafts, and have a lot of input into how they should be written.
And do you remember some of the biggest cases you worked on with her?
Well, you mentioned Cruzan, and I had actually written an article when I was in law school called Timing of Death Decisions. So I was assigned to that case, and that, I think, was a very interesting case that did decide that her living will could be imposed, I think they decided that it couldn't. But she wrote a long opinion saying that many states have living wills. I better look into this more. I don't remember it that well. I just remember working on that opinion.
And what was your relationship with her after your clerkship ended?
Well, we stayed actually pretty closely in touch. I saw her every time I went either to D.C. or then after she retired to Arizona.
And how do you view her legacy on the court?
Well, she had an amazing impact. First, she was the first woman to be on the court, and she changed the court in so many ways because of that. And her, I think the opinion that's had the most impact on me now is Strickland v. Washington with the ineffective assistance of counsel and the deference that we give to the determination by the lawyer in say a criminal case. Many of her opinions, my law clerks and I have said, my fellow law clerks have agreed that many of her opinions have been overruled. And all the ones our year were either overruled or changed. Hmm. Strickland was the term before ours.
So moving on a bit to your family, you mentioned that you had met your husband at the one of the magazines you worked for.
That's right.
So was he also a writer?
No, he was a photographer.
Photographer.
Yeah.
And so was it love at first sight? Or?
No, he was just, there were two photographers. There was a good photographer, that was my husband, and the bad photographer. And you got the bad photographer unless you buttered Ed up. So I took him out for lunch, and I did everything to try to get him to take my photos for the magazine. And one thing led to another.
And is he still in photography now?
He's retired. And he retired at the right time because now everything is digital and photoshopped.
So what type of photography did he do during his career?
He did commercial work. He did the magazines. He worked for the NFL, taking photos of their Christmas cards and other ad agencies.
So did you see, were there any similarities for your work in the law and his work in photography, or completely
Absolutely
different?
Absolutely none. And so, he has never read any of my opinions.
And no interest in your opinions?
Well, if they get into the news, he enjoys that.
Now, do the two of you have any children?
We have one child, daughter, Lillian Ikuta.
And where is she?
She's the Deputy Chief of Staff for the Mountains Resource Conservation Agency, which is a state environmental agency doing good for the environment.
Did she go to law school? Or
no, she thinks law school would be terrible.
Now, how did you... you know, I know a lot of people struggle with this. How did you balance having, you know, marriage, children, your family, and what is an exceptionally demanding career?
Well, mostly I did the career, and so I don't know that the balance was there, but they tell me it was okay.
So you muddled through okay.
Yes, exactly.
Now, after you left the Supreme Court, you chose Melvin E. Myers?
That's right.
But you had not worked there before, is that right?
I had.
So how did you pick them?
Well, I interviewed a lot at a lot of different firms in Los Angeles. Again, I wanted to stay in Los Angeles. And actually, it was a lawyer at Sidley told me, you should go to work at the law firm where you like the people the best. I said, well, that's good advice. I think I'll go to O'Melveny. So the people I had interviewed at O'Melveny and Myers were very friendly and had a great attitude, and it ended up being an excellent choice for me.
Now, how did you come to specialize in environmental law?
Well, I had worked on a couple of environmental cases, both for Judge Kuczynski and at the Supreme Court. And what I liked was mistakenly thought that they were statutory and regulatory laws. When I got more involved with environmental law at O'Melveny, I discovered that it all had to do with relationships with the state environmental people, convincing them to send you their secret law. This was before the internet, so you had to control the people at the state agencies to give you the copy of whatever directives that they were actually deciding your client's case about.
So what challenges did you face in your cases? I mean, you just mentioned one in terms of getting the secret law. Were there other challenges?
Well, California was very environmental, very pro-green, and most of my clients, of course, as I were trying to get things done within the contours of the green rules and regulations. So there's always that challenge, but that's what makes work for lawyers. So
did you find CEQA and CERCLA frustrating at times?
No, I love them. That's what made work for lawyers.
Who were your mentors at the law firm?
Well, so Owen Olpin was a very renowned environmental lawyer, especially in water law. In fact, he was chosen by the Supreme Court to be a water master in one of the river division cases. So I worked extensively with him, particularly for the Metropolitan Water District. And then Patrick Del Duca taught me everything I knew about toxic CERCLA and compliance law. And Pat Frobes, who was the head of the real estate department and then one of the three partners at the firm, really supported all of the work I was doing and helped me get into the litigation area of compliance and litigation.
Now, your Senate Judiciary Committee questionnaire mentions a number of investigations you handled for ARCO. Was that one of your biggest clients?
ARCO was, especially at the end, was one of the biggest white-collar clients that we worked for.
And how did you approach investigations of clients? Was there any particular strategy you had?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, obviously, we went through the discovery but the compliance work was more client-focused. I'm trying to, the ARCO BP work, we were seeking a declination from the task force that was investigating them. So we were getting, and we were getting RFPs, requests for protection. So it was more like pure litigation. So I think we were going through all the discovery material that would have to be produced and coming up with our theory of the case for the task force that was looking into it. I don't know if that's what you're asking.
No, that makes sense. So what did you, I guess, enjoy and not enjoy about working at a large law firm?
Well, I love the clients. I love the teamwork. I love coming up with the legal theories. What I didn't like was the administrative work. There's so much administration, and especially when I became a partner, there's even more administration, like evaluating the lawyers that you were working with and filling out the forms. That part was not so much fun.
And how did the partnership process work? How did you become a partner at the firm?
It's a black box at O'Melveny.
So just one day they just came and said, hey, you're a partner?
Well, yeah. You're talking to your mentors and saying, what does it look like? But I was really enjoying the work. I don't remember being very frantic about that. And in a sense, they told me that I was doing well and was on the partnership track, but we all knew it was a black box. And then one day they did say, well, how would you like to be a partner in O'Melveny? And of course, and you go, wow.
So aside from more administrative work, did your life change much once you became a partner at O'Melveny?
No, it continued pretty much the same other than more administrative work.
Now, shifting then to your career in public service, how did you come to the attention of Governor Schwarzenegger to be appointed general counsel of the California Resources Agency in 2004?
So I had always wanted to be on the other side of the regulatory divide to learn more so I could help my clients. I felt the more I knew about how the state agencies actually work, the more helpful I could be. I always intended to come back to the O'Melveny side. But I was looking for a administration that would take someone who is a Republican, which is pretty hard in California. So when Schwarzenegger amazingly won to become governor, I immediately sent in my application and called everyone I knew to see if there was a place for me. And I interviewed actually for both the EPA and the Resources Agency, and the Resources Agency extended an offer for me to come and be their general counsel.
And what were your responsibilities in that role?
It was such a wonderful job. It was so much fun because as a agency lawyer, you basically have the supervision of or can meddle in every important resource issue in the state of California. And also I had responsibility, sole responsibility for CEQA regulations. So I really got a crash course in California environmental law and how agencies deal with those issues.
And what were some of the challenges you faced in that position?
Well, oddly enough, Governor Schwarzenegger's policy towards environmental law was guided by his wife, Maria Shriver, and was very pro-environmentalist. And so the most issues I had was explaining to the like the buildings and the developers that they weren't going to get what they wanted.
Now, did you face any, you know, particular political pressures in the position, given what you've already mentioned, is that it's sometimes difficult to be a Republican in California?
Mike Crisman was the secretary at the Resources Agency, and he was a wonderful boss, and he said, do what's right, and that's what we did.
Did you get to work with the governor on any issue?
No, though, I certainly was in meetings. He was there, and he was, and spoke to him, but he was not closely involved in the environmental issues.
So now we'll talk about the what you're doing now. And so you had mentioned, actually, I'm going to. Okay. So we're now going to start moving into your judicial service. So you had mentioned that you had planned to go back to O'Melveny, but of course that didn't happen. How did you come to the attention of the White House and President Bush for consideration for nomination to the Ninth Circuit?
So far as I know, they were trying to identify somebody who was of a conservative Republican bent. Who could possibly be approved by the two Democratic senators at that time. It was Senator Boxer and Senator Feinstein. And they had a wide search and talked to all their contacts in California, and my name was one that came up from my my friends from clerking and my friends from the big law firms.
So how did you manage to navigate both Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer's staff to get their consent to your nomination?
Well, when I was nominated, I think the response from the press and from the people in the know was, who the hell is she? Because I had no paper trail whatsoever. And so I was really not someone that they could point to any decisions or activities I've been involved in other than as a lawyer at O'Melveny. So I think I was pretty much a blank slate. And
because you came in after Carolyn Kuhl, is that right?
Right. So Carolyn Kuhl
had
a big paper trail in the Reagan administration, and I had none. I had not been, and as a member of the Schwarzenegger administration, because he had been very pro-environmentalist. I had many environmentalist friends speaking up for me.
So what was the ABA evaluation process like?
Mostly he wanted to know why I had left Stanford to go to UC Berkeley, which is why I said I must be the only person in the world who's ever done that. He was incredulous about that. But otherwise, he asked me the same sort of questions you are, not quite in-depth, but...
Did any challenges come up to your nomination?
Well, after I had my hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, I got a series of questions from Senator Boxer, but my answers to her questions satisfied her.
And did she end up voting for you?
I don't think she ended up voting for me, but I think I was close to unanimous.
Now, when you joined the court, what were your biggest challenges when you initially took your commission and became a judge?
Well, first, there were areas of law that I didn't know about. As an environmental lawyer, I had been involved in a wide range of cases from criminal law to bankruptcy to securities. So I felt confident in those areas, but there were two areas that I was particularly ignorant about. One was immigration law. One was copyright and also death penalty law, all of which are very distinct and difficult areas of law. So I ended up spending a lot of time getting up the learning curve in those areas. And then, of course, just setting up chambers was something very new.
So how did you go about doing that?
Well, so I hired my four law clerks who also knew nothing. And I brought my secretary over from O'Melveny, and she was happy to come over, and she found out from the other JAs how to set up chambers, and so we somehow muddled along and got ready to go.
When you came to the court, were there any particular judges you looked to for guidance?
Well, when you become a Ninth Circuit judge, you're assigned a buddy judge who's supposed to help you through the process. So my buddy judge was naturally Judge Kuczynski. But that wasn't much help because he was so idiosyncratic in his methods. So I ended up getting a lot more help from Pam Reimer when she was here.
And how did you, since you had never been a judge before, how did you find your voice in writing opinions and dissents?
It was actually not very different than what I was doing at O'Melveny, though in O'Melveny I would say, you know, this is how the court should rule. Because when you're giving compliance advice or even criminal advice, you say, these are the cases, this is how it works. And so the sort of compliance writing in particular I did was very similar to what I did as a judge. And then, of course, in white-collar crime, you're writing persuasively. But as a judge, you're saying, here's what the law is, and you're trying to be as persuasive as you can about why your reading of the law is correct. So I didn't see any huge change from the type of work I was doing at O'Melveny to the type of opinion writing or dissent writing that I did as a judge on the Ninth Circuit.
So at this point, your dissents have really become must reading at the U.S. Supreme Court.
I wrote down ha ha after that. Oh, come on, here.
It's true. I defy you to find too many other judges who have more of their dissents become majority opinions at the Supreme Court. Was that something that you thought about when you started writing dissents? And how do you think you got from where you started to where you are on that?
Well, I told my clerks that we should write dissents where we think the majority is wrong, because you never know where they may end up. They may end up with the Supreme Court. They may be taken up by other circuits, or they may, long down the line, have an impact on majority opinion. So we always write dissents if I don't think that the majority is following the law. And certainly, I think the first one that had the biggest impact was the Dukes v. Walmart case.
Yes.
Where Justice Scalia basically took my dissent and made it into the Supreme Court majority, really followed the reasoning very closely.
And the Dukes case on, you know, class certification, as you know, is you know, sort of almost revolutionized class certification motions ever since. So, I mean, I think that's a perfect example of not only your dissent influencing the court, Supreme Court taking the case, but then what the rule is. So, but when you wrote that Dukes dissent, did you have that in mind, or was that just sort of a happy accident?
It's always a happy accident. I mean, you write a dissent because the majority is wrong and you want to explain to the legal public why it's wrong.
So when you get cases for your upcoming calendars, what's your approach and with your law clerks in getting prepared?
So we have most of the lawyers, most of the judges are involved in the bench memo pool, and so now that I'm usually the senior active judge, I ask my colleagues what cases they're interested in, and then we try to divide them up evenly so that they'll have presumptive writing responsibility on the cases they're interested in, and I'll assign to myself the ones I'm interested in. And then my clerks help by writing bench memos for anything we have presumptive writing responsibility. And of course, we take those very seriously, but we also look carefully at the other cases as well. Then after oral argument, if you're still in the majority for the presumptive writing responsibility, you'll write an opinion or a mem dispo, and we'll review those that are done by the other chambers.
And when do you decide so how wrong is wrong enough to want to dissent or write separately?
I almost always dissent if I disagree with the majority. Yeah, sometimes I say, well, I can go along with that, or sometimes I'll ask for a change, like, even if such and such they lose, I'll ask for changes. But most of the time, I'll write dissents. If you look at my dissents, I write dissents to mem dispos as well as to published opinions.
So how do you decide in your mind whether a case is worthy of publication or a mem dispo, and sort of what do you do with sort of the wobblers?
Well, if there's an issue on which the court has not yet written, then we almost always will decide to have a published opinion. If there's such an issue and my colleagues have it wrong, I encourage that them to be made mem dispos so it doesn't become the law of the court. On wobblers, we have a phrase that, you know, dealer's choice. Whoever has the presumptive writing responsibility can decide whether to make it an opinion or not.
And how do you decide whether to submit without argument?
Usually the case is very straightforward, so that it's controlled by existing case law, in which case, and if all of the judges agree, it just makes more sense to decide it in the mem dispo without hearing oral argument.
And what do you do to prepare for oral argument? Any do you do more than what you've already just done to prepare with the, you know, the memos and going back and forth? Is there anything additional you do for oral argument?
Well, I always go through the case right before we hear oral arguments. So I'm sure I have the issues in my mind, and then I ask my clerk to come in and tell me if I've noticed anything or what sort of points may be made by the advocates, so I'll be well prepared.
And do you find oral argument helpful or not helpful or sometimes helpful? Or I guess then the question is, what would make it helpful if it's not generally helpful?
Well, generally, we're very well acquainted with the law and the facts so that the oral argument normally doesn't change our minds. And sometimes I say that they can be changed by a fatal admission. So, like, it turns out the case is moot, or it turns out that they aren't going to raise the argument that one of my colleagues thought was winning. But most of the time, they don't change our minds.
So what is the process you go through when you see other opinions coming through from other panels to decide whether you want to call a case en banc?
I hardly ever call a case en banc. You know, I'll join in votes where there's en banc. The times when I've done that, it's just nobody else. I always let other people jump in first. No one else has called it en banc, and it needs, like, Cedar Point was one of them, and Americans for Prosperity v. Bonta. Nobody else was calling them, and they were just so wrong.
And then what makes you decide to write the dissent as opposed to signing on to somebody else's dissent?
When I think they're wrong in a different way.
Now, when you sit on motions panels, how do you approach questions on, like, discretionary review, like 23F petitions or CAFA removals or injunction stays?
Motions panels are really hard because the staff attorneys who present them are from San Francisco, and they've got a San Francisco viewpoint, and we're doing it in a way that it's hard to bring your own lawyers, your own law clerks into it. A lot of them are really straightforward, but when they're not, I will assign them to a law clerk and get help in determining what to do. I mean, I've also written dissents to motions because I thought the majority was deciding them wrong. I've sort of bowed out. We were able not to take the, what do we call them? Where did you say that? Not motions panel.
The screening panel.
The screening. I can take an extra day or two and get out of the screening, which I do, because there isn't really time to give them the read through and to decide on my own whether I think they're correct or not.
And so you, I take it from that, you prefer working with your own law clerks.
Right, because they can give me an objective view as opposed to the San Francisco view of the case.
And is there a difference? I know you mentioned before we went on tape that you had an en banc argument this week. Is there a difference in preparing for an en banc argument? Especially since if you weren't on the panel, you might not have had the same workup before.
So the en banc, so I assign a clerk to it, and we spend some time getting ready. We read all of the briefs. So often there's a set of briefs that went to the panel, and a different set of briefs that go to the en banc panel. Then there's the en banc call memo and the response, all the en banc traffic that we look at. Then taking all that into account, the panel opinion that was created, we go through it the same way we would a case that was for oral argument. There's just more material and more analysis by my colleagues.
So do you think the court takes the right number of en bancs, or do you think they should take more?
Well, I think they should take less, because the en banc decisions come out not being very helpful. Sometimes you have five opinions coming out, and sometimes the law gets less clear than it was before the en banc decision.
Do you think that's a function of the fact that it's still a random sampling of the court, and that with 11 members that it's not necessarily representative of the full court?
Well, statistically, they claim it is representative of the whole court. I don't know if that's true or not. But I think if you get three judges, you're more likely to get a majority in a dissent. If you have 11 judges, you get two majorities and five dissents.
Yes, and I suppose if you had 29 judges, who knows,
it would be
chaos, yes.
We for a while, we experimented at Senator Feinstein's suggestion on 15. We had agreed to do it for 2 years, and we all quit after a year. Everyone agreed it was terrible. The conferences lasted forever. It was even more confusing. The lawyers didn't know who was asking the question. It was not very functional.
Now, before we get into some opinions, just talk just a little broadly about the role of a judge. So at your confirmation hearing, you told the committee it was important that judges follow the rule of law and apply that law in a neutral and impartial way. And you also, I think this was in a, this might have been in your follow-up to Senator Boxer, I see the role of the judge in our system as interpreting the law, the precedents of the Supreme Court and the judge's circuit, and applying those laws impartially and fairly to the legal issues before the court. Now that you've been a judge for a fair amount of time, is there anything that you would add to that?
I agree with that completely, and that's what I strive for. I've never varied from that.
Now, do you think that would be the consensus view of your colleagues, or do you think there would be other views of what is the proper role of a judge?
You know, I think every one of my colleagues would agree with that, but I think in practice they don't actually follow that. I mean, I saw in many cases where there's a way to reach, well, but I shouldn't go into this. I mean, off the record, the judges are very result-oriented.
Mm-hmm. So let's move into some major opinions. I mean, I have questions about a few of them, but before we get into that, is there one or two opinions that you think are your most important majority opinions you've written?
Well, the one that's lasted the longest was Google v. Perfect Ten, though I understand that's under a lot of pressure to change.
So what makes that significant in your mind?
it protected Google, really. It was a decision that, I think they call it the server test, that if you're merely pointing, if you're copying a material that's appearing in somebody else's server, so the browser is merely pointing you to the server, that is not a copyright violation. And I think a lot of people, there's been a lot of discussion in the legal world, including in the Ninth Circuit, that's an erroneous decision. So I've been following that with some interest. But the server test still prevails in the Ninth Circuit.
Any other cases that come to mind? Well,
certainly the ones that have influenced the Supreme Court that we've already discussed, some of them.
Well, so let's talk about a few. So
you're now getting into an area where I didn't have a chance to go back and refresh my recollection.
So the National Pork Producers Council versus Ross case, that was the Commerce Clause challenge to
the Dormant Commerce Clause. Proposition and they said 12. Pike's Church still survives.
And so you upheld the Proposition 12, which sort of barred pork sales where the pigs were confined in a cruel manner. The Supreme Court affirmed you, I think, in a more confusing way than your opinion. I mean, that area of the law is a real mess.
I agree.
You know, I think you, my sense on your opinion, you were doing your best to apply the existing precedent. I was hoping that the Supreme Court would clarify it. I'm not sure they did. I suspect there will be many more of those cases.
Well, especially if they're doing with Pike's,
The Pike's balancing.
Yeah, where, and Scalia said, that's whether a line is longer than a stone is heavy. You know, it's like, how do you do this sort of balancing? It just calls out to be result-oriented.
Right, and then you had the Olean Wholesale Grocery versus Bumblebee Foods, which is a class certification case on the sort of de minimis, where you could have more than a de minimis number of people in the class not injured. Again, that's, I think, a confusing area of the law.
I don't know that opinion made it more clear either, but...
Well, I think that's just sort of a difficult area that I think there'll probably be a lot more litigation on. I think the Becerra versus Azar case on the Title 10 regulations I think the barring funds for programs that support abortion en banc opinion. I think that sort of interesting. The Supreme Court didn't take that. Presumably, they agreed with your en banc opinion, and there wasn't really a split.
Yeah, what do you think the effect of Loper Bright is going to be? I'm always asking that question, my coach. Is this a Loper Bright issue? I mean, do we now say, well, this is a regulation where the authority was delegated to the agency, or are we actually just looking at the language of the statute?
I think you're probably just looking at the language of the statute.
Yeah, I think a lot of these
are going to be
hard cases will now become... statutory depends on the panel you get.
Yes, and looking at the statute, I think there's going to be a lot of relitigation over a lot of these things.
I agree.
Then you had the City of L.A. versus Barr on the...
That issue is going to become real important, I think, because that was depriving the state of funds through these particular couple of different mechanisms. Because they weren't doing what the feds wanted on immigration law. And I can see that same issue now arising with President Trump's view that that some implementation of the immigration law has to be done.
Oh, yeah. I think there's going to be a ton of litigation over that. There's no doubt. Well, then one case that you must be... pleased about is the DNC versus Hobbs case, where your panel on the various Arizona election laws, where your panel opinion upheld the rules, you were reversed by en banc, and then the Supreme Court came in and agreed with your panel opinion.
Yeah, it's always gratifying.
Now, turning to some of your dissents, you had mentioned the Cedar Point nursery case on the sort of union regulations allowing organizers access to the agricultural employers work sites. You had Doe versus San Diego Unified School District on vaccines in schools. I mean, some of these are some of the, you know, big ticket items, and, you know, sort of, union activities, vaccines, then the Americans for Prosperity you mentioned on public disclosure of donor names. I mean, these are some of the hottest topics. You know, when you decide to dissent, I mean, do you factor in that these are, such important, I mean, the fact that it's an important issue, I take it goes into the calculus as to whether it's worth putting a dissent from denial of en banc.
Yes. As I said, I don't call a lot of cases en banc, but when I do call them en banc, I feel pretty strongly that the majority got it wrong. And so I do everything I can to make a persuasive dissent.
And would you say that Dukes versus Walmart was sort of your first big sort of dissent that sort of, you know, got traction at the Supreme Court that you
remember? Yes, definitely.
And
surprisingly enough, Judge Kaczynski asked me to, as a senior judge in dissent, he was the one who asked me to draft that.
Well, and that, you know, I could say, you know, as someone who does a lot of class certification oppositions and consulting in the district courts, and then 23F petition, the Dukes case is about as seminal as it gets. So now we're nearing the end, just a couple more topics, and I will let you go. Law clerks, you've mentioned a little bit. By now, you've had quite a number of law clerks. I know you recently had a law clerk reunion.
Yeah.
How did you enjoy that?
It was wonderful. I mean, everywhere I looked was an old friend, and it was wonderful seeing them all.
Yes, well, I know both Stephanie and Jazz Jeff were working very hard on organizing parts of that.
Yes.
Now I'm not going to ask you to name any favorites. I'm sure you have some, but how do you view your law clerk family as a whole?
Well, it's wonderful. The group of really bright, hardworking, ambitious people just going into a dozen different ways, and I'm so proud of all of them.
So how do you go about selecting them each year?
Well, I ask my law clerks to screen the applications we get, and then they choose a group. Then I look at them, and then we interview them. And normally, by the time they get to the question whether we're going to ask them to come in for an interview, the only thing we're worried about is are they going to get along? Because it's very important that you have a friendly class.
And how do you rely on them in doing your work?
Well, they are the first line of defense for everything. They have to follow my cases, the ones that they're assigned to, and tell me if I need to do something. They do the first draft of the bench memo and the first draft of the opinion. And then, especially with the opinions, it goes through a lot of rewriting because the opinions, in a sense, all have to be in my voice.
So, again, without naming names, I know vast majority of your law clerks have been exceptional. I'm sure you've had maybe one or two clunkers over the years. What, in your experience, what makes for a bad or a less good law clerk?
It's hard to say. Obviously, it's the same things that you look for in a law firm, but somebody who's very bright and fast and a good worker. I'd say a lot of times it's some are faster than others, and certainly at the speed that we need to get the work out, being fast is better than being slow. And also sometimes, this is rare, but a law clerk will have a particular perspective and struggles with my perspective. And so that can slow things down as well.
So then finally, just some sort of issues in the Ninth Circuit. We talked a little bit about the 11-judge en banc panel, that it's may not be perfect, but it's probably the best solution. Another topic I know you have an opinion on, does the court rely too heavily on visiting judges? And is there a risk that distorts circuit precedent?
I'm real unhappy with the visiting judge, but I think most of my colleagues agree. And now that we're at 29 with like 20 senior judges, it's not as big of an issue. And I think we are cutting down on visiting judges.
So what's your biggest pet peeve about the lawyers you see, both in and the biggest problem in briefing and at oral argument?
It's really disheartening when you're in oral argument and the lawyer is not familiar with the record. That's always a problem. And it's equally a problem they're not familiar with the law. And we do see that as well. A lot of times in certain areas where there's not, where the clients don't have a lot of money, like in immigration law and sometimes criminal law, where they've got a panel member, CJA panel member, where the lawyers just don't have the time to do a good job. In immigration law in particular, we'll get briefs. I've gotten one recently where they don't even know who their client is. They have the gender wrong and the issues wrong. So that's really the disservice to the clients is real unfortunate.
So what do you think the biggest challenge facing your court is? Is it the size or something else?
Well, I don't know that there was a big influx of judges that were nominated by the Biden administration, and I'm not sure they've settled down into their method for working. That will happen in the next 4 or 5 years. And then I think it's hard to say what the biggest challenge will be. I haven't really thought about that.
So do you think that the Ninth Circuit's improving? It used to be the most reversed court during your earlier tenure on the court, but in the past few years, like the Fifth Circuit and other circuits have been reversed more, although there's still some high-profile reversals of the Ninth. How would you rate the court as a whole?
Well, we were reversed all the time on AEDPA issues and qualified immunity issues. And I think we've settled down and followed the Supreme Court guidance after they told us 10 or 12 times what they wanted. I think we'll be seeing reversals or at least something on our Second Amendment jurisprudence, because the Ninth Circuit has never seen a gun law that they wouldn't uphold. And I'm not sure the Supreme Court has gone that far, even in Rahimi. So I think it's more on an issue basis than we're a bad court basis.
And any thoughts on what could be done to further improve the court or its reputation?
Well, I think we should all do a better job of following the law. But I think every judge you talk to will say that they follow the law. It's just they do it in a different way.
And then just the last couple questions sort of on your legacy on the court. Many, many years from now, how would you like your service on the court to be remembered?
Well, I was looking back through my comments on the nomination. I said that I wanted them to say that I would be impartial and fair, and I think that would be the best legacy I could leave. My other legacy, of course, is all the wonderful law clerks that have gone through that will long outlive me and my usefulness to the court.
What do you consider your greatest accomplishment as a judge?
I have not gotten an answer to that question, sorry.
Fair enough. Any disappointments so far in your judicial service?
No, I feel so privileged. From the first day, I felt very privileged and honored to have this job. I still, when I think about it and how unlikely it is that I would get this position, I still feel the same way. I'm very grateful. The court has been wonderful to me.
And last question, what do you wish you knew when you became a judge that you know now?
I can't answer that question either. I don't know.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You went through very quickly, and I probably said some things that